Well, boys, looks like you started the fun without me.
You're all sick. Every last one of you.
We're going to need a bigger gun.
What's the matter? You scared of things that go boom, boom, boom?
Give me one goddamn reason why I shouldn't blow your goddamn brains all over that goddamn wall.
My name is Eric 13, and I am here with Nine Inch Nails remix Michael Kester.
Wow, that's
did
what
you
I...
get that? You get that fixed today, or what's the deal?
Yeah, no, I'm all still right. Broken.
Not what I meant to do. Doesn't even matter. Look, we got movies on this show. You think you're gonna derail me? You're not gonna fucking. You know my favorite thing about the fixed EP?
Yeah,
no, I'm derailed.
It's
right.
Blue instead of orange.
Stop.
Because it's blue.
Stop. You know why? Because everything's blue in this world. That's why I can do this for 49 minutes,
cool.
Buddy.
Yeah.
I can do it.
I believe you can.
Oh, I'm trying to believe with Michael Kester. And today we have two movies that are on the show. No, you're right. I can't do this.
Yeah.
I
no, I've been looking forward to joining you finally on this show.
You know what's funny? It's we're not using any of the ones we usually use.
I know. So
every time this happens, it's a brand new fucking thing.
That's pretty good.
It's just... these are... Listen. I don't like all this non-inclusive stuff you're throwing at me. These are Nine Inch Nails jokes. I'm going to break
Nine-inch
the...
Nails. Yeah.
The nin. They're Nine Inch Nails lyrics. We just repeat them to each other as long as
composer,
we can.
The composer for... The composer for
that NASA short film, yeah, I know.
Social Network.
Oh yes, right.
Used to be in a band called Nine Inch Nails.
I think he's still more in that band than I don't really know what the joke is here. There's a joke about that.
I'll tell you what the joke is that neither of these films have anything to do with Trent Reznor or Nine Inch Nails. In fact,
not even a little bit.
If I could
complete my fucking thought, though.
Sorry.
The gag, Michael, is that you just
jump from every rooftop.
Feel 1 million miles away. What you do is you just start spouting lyrics with, I do this in conversation, not always with Nine Inch Nails, but I'll cop to a different thing because I've already gotten bored of explaining what we were just doing.
Mm-hmm.
But when I get bored in a conversation and I can't get out of it because I'm really, really fucking socially awkward, I will just start responding with lyrics.
Sure.
And just see if I can, like, it's all in the eyes,
right.
You know, it doesn't matter what you're saying. We learned this from films. It doesn't fucking matter what you're saying. It's just all up in the eyes. So if you just connect at a real deep level and then just, you know.
That's a good segue. So today we're covering two films about getting a free pass on murdering millions of humans. It's all in the eyes. So we're going to talk about, it's an HBO film from the 90s called Truman. It's about President Harry Truman.
Mm-hmm.
And then we're pairing that with, it is about as close as you can literally get to a US war propaganda documentary called The Atomic Cafe.
Well, I think it's a series of, it's like the ABCs of death.
Right. It's like Mondo Kane, but like Bombdo Kane.
Right.
In fact, that's what it's called now. So we're going to pair Truman with Bombdo Kane.
This is 95 Truman and 82 Atomic Cafe.
Yeah. So films don't necessarily line up, but you know, we're talking about a president from the fucking 40s. So
I was just trying to, as quickly as I could, throw people off the path. What you've done here is a little thing called showing your hand. I think people know how you feel about the bomb. I think.
Thing about the bomb.
That sound denotes I may have spoken too soon.
It's not, I'm not even sure the conversation today is going to necessarily end with how I feel about the bomb.
Here's the thing about the bomb, Michael Kester.
I think what instead we're going to find out is the bizarre circumstances that have led us to 2018. I think is
really
that's what I want to know. That's what I want to get to the bottom of.
Okay. All right.
So if you're disinterested in Gary Sinise's amazing portrayal of my favorite US president, second favorite US president, then skip to like halfway through when we're just going to be straight up talking about bombing. You have to know it's Hiroshima. You have to know how to say it.
All right. Hold on a second. Truman's your second favorite U.S. president?
Second favorite U.S. president.
The guy who drops the atomic bomb is your second favorite U.S. president?
I mean, you don't have to like your favorite president.
His environmental policy, though, is really great. And Michael has a lot to say about that.
Strong.
That's a huge surprise to me. I don't know. I'm not entirely... Maybe by the end of this conversation, I'll know better about how I feel. But it's... This is one of those things that kind of takes me back a step, especially from where we used to be on ye olde days of your double feature, where I feel extremely heated about something, but I don't feel extremely like I know what I feel about that something.
Yeah.
Atomic weapon. Well, let me tell you the fucking deal with the atomic weapon. Here's what nobody's saying about the I don't actually know, but I still feel that inside. I feel that like... All right, you all sit here and listen to me rant about atomic bombs. I don't really know what I feel about atomic bombs.
No, I think...
don't set them off. I'll start there.
I think Harry Truman made... So first off, let me just go ahead and make it even more confusing. My favorite president is Jimmy Carter. The thing about this film and the thing about Harry Truman's presidency is that there's a few things that are interesting to me. One is that he was a Democrat. That got elected after a Democratic two-term president. Kind of basically the same situation as George H.W. Bush from our last Journey episode, remember?
Mm-hmm.
And he didn't win the re-election. But the other thing that I think is really interesting is to look at what happened to Harry Truman as far as inheriting the presidency and... how he went on to just drop an atomic bomb. I mean, when you think about from the narrative of this guy's life, right? And then the movie is exactly that. When you think about the fact that somebody went, hey, you're the president now. And basically his next move was, well, I think I know how to end the war. And what's amazing to me about that decision is... I don't think that there's an argument to be made that it was necessarily the right decision. I think it's, or rather, I don't think that there is a definitive argument. Sorry. I don't think there's a definitive argument that it was the right or wrong decision. But I think what's most interesting to me is if you look at Roosevelt, his predecessor as sort of, you know, his mentor, as his boss, right?
Mm-hmm.
Do you think Roosevelt would have dropped the bomb?
And then halfway through the show, we're going to do this cafe, which I have a little bit different feelings about than you. And there are spoilers in the show. I just, fighting crime with a partner, Lois Lane, Jimmy Carter. Now I've gotten out all the things that were on my mind.
Cool.
That I wanted to give you a moment to finish. That was a really long sentence that took 8 minutes, but I believe we're accidentally already into Truman.
Cool.
Were you posing that as a question?
I mean, it was a rhetorical question. I think that's the most interesting thing to me is that Truman's decision to drop the bomb to me seems like at the time in the context of the question, should we drop the bomb? I'm really surprised with the outcome.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And then it's funny too, because resonating all the way to 2018, if you ask that question now, I think we all have the same answer all the time, which is really interesting to look at a point in history where we all kind of went, I guess maybe.
God, I guess the best thing to do at this point is lean into that question because I don't know, it seems like we're here. So why not go with it? Also, this is a presidents and propaganda show. I'm going to keep doing the intro for the next 40 minutes.
You don't have time. No time.
No, I just feel like if this is your first episode of Double Feature,
that's
you're
going to
be like, where am I? This is my 500-something episode of Double Feature, and I'm still like, where am I? Yeah, 400-something? See, I don't even know the episode number yet.
It's okay.
Okay. So... yeah, you've hit on the biggest question around dropping the bomb is always, you know, should we have done it? And as an American, I think about that question as impossible to fucking interpret. Because, listen, if you were to have a debate through world history about some of the most horrific acts of that history, this is a clear contender. this has to be in that conversation. Now, the answer to whether or not it was falls largely on if you think we needed to drop the bomb or not, I think. I think if you're outraged that, oh, with everything that's happened in the world, how could you say this was one of the most horrific acts? Then, yeah, you probably think we needed to drop the bomb.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, ask Japanese people if we needed to drop the bomb. I think you're going to get a much more clearly stable answer than you would hear.
I think, too, there's a stupid comedy movie that it's called Totally Awesome. I'm sure you remember me talking about it.
Yeah.
There's this really stupid moment that I always think about when I think about Harry Truman dropping the bomb in Japan, which is there's a character who says something along the lines of, they dropped the first bomb. I get it. It's war. And then they dropped a second bomb. And to me, that was a little much.
So that's another thing that I think... Here's a few things that maybe we can bring to this. One is that if we go back and look in Truman at the, hey, let's return to the intro for a moment. Part of these presidents and propaganda films, what they've shown us over and over is that they're not good. So it's, if you want to get a history lesson and think deeply about these questions, 1995's HBO documentary Truman, probably not the place to do that.
Sure.
But it's hard for me to, if we're not doing it here, we're doing it some like Adamsploitation movie.
Yeah.
And once you bring up a conversation, we've talked about this in shows before, but you bring something up like, hey, atomic bomb, should we be dropping that? We got a lot more scenes left. So yeah, go ahead and drop that because we got to talk about like farmers and stuff. It's pretty hard for me to not go, well, hold on, let's stay on this bomb here for a moment, you know?
I mean, but I think the whole thing that I want to talk about today is kind of the legacy of this president throughout the rest of American history. I think that there's an argument to be made that American history would look vastly different if this president had made a different decision. Can you imagine a Cold War without having dropped a bomb once?
Well, see, this is part of what makes it so fucking complicated. So the first thing that makes it complicated is that we're Americans. So
but that's the complicated thing of this entire journey. We're going to take that for granted.
Okay, excellent. Excellent. A good way to dispel what is initially problematic at the onset. But I mean, the Victor writes history. So then we also have the fact that there's a narrative quality through this, and it starts at the White House. The White House gets to begin to spin this narrative. And the way they did it, and what was believed for many, many years, is that, X number of people, fact, did you know, says White House, X number of people would have died, but only a couple people died because of that A-bomb. So really, we saved a lot of lives. A lot of Japanese lives we've saved, bigly. Mm-hmm. It sounds like something someone would say fucking bigly.
Mm-hmm.
So it's pretty good to assume, especially these days, anything the White House says is the truth, but the opposite of it.
Mm-hmm.
So like the current president only tells the truth, but the opposite. You can just look at him, hear what he says, and then flip that, and that is the fact. And I don't know if I can hammer this in any harder. So the White House fucking lies to you. So yeah, they just made up a number and they said, well, it's going to save a lot of people. And that started a narrative. And what I think the narrative is, and you tell me if you from growing up in America and about the same, I mean, almost literally the same time and place I did, let's get a very diverse data set here.
Two white guys from suburban Chicago.
Who are what, 2 years apart? Yeah.
Maybe.
In the same like fucking suburb, basically. I don't know about your side of the Elgin tracks, but let me tell you, over in Bartlett, here's what we thought about the A-bomb.
Right. I went to parochial school. That's
you
the
hoity-toity St. Charles types. Yeah. On the other side of the pond, literally a pond, can tell me what you thought. So then the narrative quality in my mind goes, okay, we dropped this bomb, a bomb that was so devastating that it was part of really the greatest example in human history of shock and awe, that they would see the devastating power of this single attack, which is not even as powerful in terms of death tolls as the all-out war that occurred in many other places, or the invention of a device like the drone, let's say. for the sum total of its carnage versus how many people were ever lost to an atom bomb. So we just dropped this little bomb. It shocked everybody. And then we dropped another bomb just to go, hey, there's a fucking series of these, and this we could just do this every day. So you should give up before a third one of these happens. The second bomb created the urgency, and then Japan surrendered because of us and not because of anything to do with Russia. And that ended the war, the last world war. We were very successful. We not only ended World War II, but all future world wars, and now there's peace.
Mm-hmm.
And we got the Rocky films, or at least that third
one. True. Fourth one, yeah.
Oh, fuck, you're right. Because there is a narrative quality to that, I find that things with a narrative quality usually have more falsehoods to them. Because okay, yeah. you smoothed them over with narrative. That's not to say anything with a narrative is an all-out lie. But because it sounds a little bit like, okay, I could see that. That makes sense. I could see that. It seems a little workshopped to me.
Sure.
And I tend to get skeptical when that happens.
Mm-hmm.
Did you kind of have that idea of how the bomb played out that same way?
It's really interesting to me that through the context of this film, that narrative is not what brings him down to 30% approval rating.
Right.
You know what I mean? Yeah, like, I think that your point is made in the fact that he dropped the bomb and it wasn't until he fired some general that people didn't like him.
Yeah.
And so the narrative is effective. And I think that, I mean, man, I don't know. It's hard to figure out. I think the answer is pretty obvious. It's hard to figure out where in American history the government started lying to the people, but I'm pretty sure it's 1776-ish.
Right.
And it's interesting how the glamour of the narrative was so much easier swallowed in the 1940s than it would be now. Like, I feel like if the exact same story were pitched right now, everybody would be like, that's bullshit.
Yeah. Yeah, well, they might have said that then, too. But it's also harder because of record. And this is why I'm so happy we're doing the Atomic Cafe. This is going to be talking about like how the record changes over time or how our narrative changes over time. And I actually think because of that, Truman might be more of the propaganda film. I know that's like dropping my own atomic bomb on the show to say that.
Yeah,
but let's see when we get
you're
to Atomic
Cafe. You're kind of getting ahead of the whole story here, Eric. This journey is supposed to end up somewhere that you're getting ahead of.
Okay, sorry. I didn't mean to. Listen, when you have as few votes that made a difference as did, Hillary could have lost for any reason. But because of that, you can also say she lost for X reason. Or why reason.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel like that has shown me this little thing in a perfect situation in a petri dish we've created has taught me so much about narratives because we have something that is so, I don't know if malleable is the right word, but just you can take the last American election and whatever pet issue you have, literally anything that might have swayed a couple thousand fucking votes, you could be like, and that's why they...
I mean, it's the Jill Stein argument, right?
Well, it's any argument. Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, Twitter didn't have night mode yet. And if Twitter had had night mode, Hillary would have won, which might be fucking true. We're talking about a couple thousand votes, literally anything. If some people slept longer or not as long, if more people were motivated to, you know, it's all about turnout, you know, they say. And because of that, you know, that one little thing has caused me to look back through history so much and really think about, okay, well, I see this
the butterfly effect. That's what it sounded like you were going to go to.
No, I mean, maybe that too.
If these two people had copulated when they were interrupted by their family in 1976, they would have had three more children who would have then had a bunch of liberal offspring in Michigan.
Yes. Well, I mean, that speaks to your Cold War question, right? That's the butterfly effect right there. We wouldn't have gotten Godzilla, which is really the unfortunate. Yeah. Would you make
barely,
the trade? Would you
barely,
have made the trade? You could save those lives, but we wouldn't have gotten Godzilla.
I don't know, man.
Or we would have gotten American Godzilla much sooner.
Ooh, and true.
That would be much worse. My point is just that I think about, okay, so 50 years from now, when people look back at this election, are they going to go, it was the fucking coal miners? Is that going to be the winning narrative? Because, you know, more people who work at 7-Elevens swayed the fucking election than coal miners did.
Mm-hmm.
Coal miners are like literally maybe not even enough people to have swayed the election. There's so few of them. But everybody talked about them after the election. All of that's written, it's documented somewhere, and people might look back in 50 years and say something ridiculously stupid, like Hillary didn't care enough about the coal miners.
Like, which president would you rather have a beer with?
Well, I mean, that has a narrative quality to it, too, that we can go, here's the fallacy of who would you rather have a beer with, and there's an important lesson we should learn from it. I don't know if that's actually why I lost. That's what I've been led to believe through history, but
sure.
I'm starting to question everything we see in history and just look at the opposite of whatever the propaganda films say. Well,
but
and go,
again,
well, I think maybe it's this.
To go back to Harry Truman, he was reelected post-bomb.
That does tell you, yeah, that tells you a lot because that is a money where your mouth is kind of moment.
Yeah.
There.
I mean, barely, right? Everybody expected this, you know, landslide victory for Dewey or whatever, but it didn't happen. And
yeah.
And that means, I mean, sure, maybe bipartisanship was that sheer all the way back in the 1940s, 50s era, but I honestly believe there is a tactile reality, something that has eluded every single war since World War II, which is the finality of dropping that bomb. I think that there is a resonant quality, however fucking horrible. He dropped a fucking period on the story of World War II.
Yeah.
He went, it ends right now. And every war that America has been involved in since then, and probably ongoing, has been this ideological thing where I guess we're getting out of there so the war is over. But I mean, the definitive end to the Korean War, the definitive end to Vietnam, the definitive end to the Iraq War, we're still at war on terror, on drugs. We're still at war with...
It's really, you know, the appeal of the finality of the war that you appreciate.
That's
as a pacifist, you like when you do something so horrific, the war has to have been over
it's
already.
It's not... I mean, the horrificness is what it is, but I think that the predication of ending a war by your own hand is a powerful move. And I think that that is where the re-election came from. That said, are we Atomic Cafe time?
Yeah, sure.
So that said, the bomb itself is the worst fucking thing. And it begs...
Oh, good, a segment I can relate to.
There's two questions that I really want to dive into, and one is the disgusting notion of, thank God America got the bomb.
Mm-hmm.
Thank God we bombed them first, because it could have gone the other way, and that would have been terrible, but good thing America's got it, so we're all safe, and the world's okay, because America has the bomb.
Yeah.
But my other sort of thing that I want to talk about, and I think that this is a good place to do it, because you and I have definitely talked about it off the air quite a bit and on the air now and again, but the idea of you can't disinvent something.
Mm-hmm.
The idea of you kind of go, this bomb exists. The Manhattan Project has been successful. And now what do you do? Do you pretend you don't have the bomb? Do the Russians get the bomb first?
Yeah.
What if the Russians drop the bomb first? I mean, is this just a race to drop the bomb? Is this Sputnik? Is this Space Wars? You know, are we just trying to get something there so we can say we did it first and like set ourselves up as the ones with the thing or the ones who did the stuff? And the reality is you can't disinvent something. And so the question becomes, do you just never use something once it's invented? Or do you have to use it?
The way that it was presented, now that we're in the Atomic Cafe, to think back about Truman, because fuck it, that's where they talked about it. Sorry, I'm just going to go back for a little second. We'll just dip into the Truman, grab this bit and pull it into...
It's two films, yeah, yeah.
All right.
Truman did drop the bomb, despite the fact that it did happen in the previous film.
Right.
In reality...
Previously in the Atomic
Cafe. We're not talking about the film. We're talking about Harry Truman's presidency.
Well, no, I wanted to talk about the film for a second. Well, no, because there's the moment in the film where he goes, hey, whatever happened to that plan to like drop it in the sea just as a show of force? And the general just sort of shrugged and went, I don't know, but anyways. And so if we want to look at your question and go the other part of this narrative, wasn't the bomb always going to drop? Wasn't right. the conclusion always someone would drop one bomb and then everybody on Earth would look at it and go, let's not do that anymore, so we might as well get this over with? That also has a certain ring to it of absolute nonsense to me.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But I don't know why. Maybe sure. it's true.
I mean, it's...
None of us really fucking know at the end of the day.
Well, I mean, we're all... For how long, you know, and how constantly... Is World War III right around the corner? And the answer is always, it's been right around the corner since the first bomb was dropped, right?
Mm-hmm.
The inevitable nuclear demise of mankind came from seeing a taste of atomic destruction. And suddenly we all saw in that moment how it all ended.
Sure, yeah.
Which is crazy for a few reasons. One, because despite the fact that I know that this has been a... hysterical narrative forever, I'm still terrified of it, one.
Mm.
And two, I hate it because you look at it in 2017 versus the Atomic Cafe, which is like, hell yeah, the bomb. Let's all sit. You want to go to a bomb watching party? And now it's in 2018 and I'm going, man, like, sure, like, the planet's dying, you know, the planet is, we're killing the planet. The climate is changing. The inevitable demise of mankind is coming about regardless, but I'm more scared of the bomb.
All right. Well, rather than answer that, because
it's not a question.
Today's show is the craziest fucking thing ever.
Till next week.
Let's drag this thing out and shine a light on it about the Atomic Cafe, where I disagree yeah. about this. Because I don't think the Atomic Cafe says that. I think Duck and Cover says that.
You don't think the Atomic Cafe says what? Be afraid of the bomb?
I don't think the Atomic Cafe says, isn't the bomb cool?
Really?
Yeah. And here's why.
Okay.
It's 1982, right?
Okay.
We're yeah. coming out of Vietnam. Hatred for the government at an all-time high. What the Atomic Cafe is doing is creating a sort of black humor documentary
mm-hmm.
about... how really just a totally cynical point of view, one that the most anti-government ideas espoused on today's show thus far would be in line with. But it's doing so by doing a thing that I would have just said is dubious, but maybe I'll say it failed because you don't even like pick this up at all. But it's doing so without any voiceover and without any interviews. So at the time that the movie came out, yeah. you know, they're going through all of this archival footage to pull up stuff. It's Reefer Madness. It's the totally. Rocky Horror reaction to Reefer Madness.
I can see that. Yeah, totally.
But we don't pick that up today watching it. In 1982, everybody knew that.
Mm-hmm.
But here we are in 2018.
The pendulum has swung all the way back.
Right. And so now it's like, is it completely lost on us today? If yeah. they made this as something as simple as, let's say, an anti-war film, mm-hmm. although I think as a documentary, it's trying to be a little less, it's trying to have less of a viewpoint than that, but it doesn't read the way, it will never read the way it did in 82. And unlike a documentary that has its own, I don't know, something simple, something stupid, VO, just the director telling you everything to think in the documentary. Mm-hmm. Because it doesn't have that, it leaves the footage open for way more interpretation all this time later.
Mm-hmm.
It just becomes a stroll down atomic memory right. lane. And, you know, the things that the 80s thought were stupid in the 50s, we think are stupid about the 80s now. So a lot of the technique that it used, I feel like has been lost over mm-hmm. the decades.
I think that's probably true. Yeah. That's
Which
a good point.
Says a lot more about art and documentaries than
sure.
I thought.
But I mean, it also says a lot about kind of what I was saying about the unwavering constant fear of the bomb right mm-hmm. after Harry Truman dropped it. Is the fact that in the 80s, they were going, God, can you believe this fucking bomb bullshit? Like, look, mm-hmm. look at all these soldiers that are going, oh, I've seen 10 bomb drops and you're lucky to see one today, lad.
Yeah.
And now I'm watching that and still baffled by it. And I've been saying this a lot and I think it kind of applies here. I think the most effective films of any given time are also the least effective films 6 months later. I think that it is few and far between that a film comes out in, let's say, 2017, and exactly 365 days later, you watch that film and feel that it is as moving, as important as it was the previous year.
Yeah.
I think of a film like Get Out as an example. Although, you know, you and I are going to love Get Out forever, and a lot of people are going to love Get Out forever. But at the time Get Out came out, it was a perfect storm of great film and also perfect for the zeitgeist. One of my thoughts about why that is, especially to use the ubiquity of Get Out as an example, is I think when a film works artistically, it shifts that narrative. I think when Get Out comes out and everybody sees it for the first time in a world without Get Out, and they go, holy shit, this is saying such and such a thing, everybody walks out of the theater in a world after Get Out.
Yeah.
And I think that the social narrative changes to a post-Get Out world. And I think an effective film, and I'm not saying that The Atomic Cafe had made a huge splash in cinema in 1982, because I had to do a lot of digging to find it. But I am saying that an effective film loses something as time goes on. Because if you're speaking to your peers in that time and place, you have to use that verbiage, you have to use that language, and you have to appeal to that era, that time, that moment. And I think that there are ways to make films that last, you know, films that last forever. I think Jurassic Park, I think Taxi Driver, you know. Mm-hmm. I think some of the 90th percentile films in history. But I think that the 100% films that are just one, and I'm not talking about that website, I'm talking about effectiveness. Uh-huh.
You're just choosing to rate effectiveness by percent for some strange reason. Could you rate it in terms of vegetables?
Sure.
Would it be possible to?
Yeah, I think that if you had like
how fresh would the vegetables be?
Pretty fresh.
Okay, like, pretty. It gets a certified pretty fresh.
It's not certified. There's no certification for the vegetables.
Oh, whoa, sorry. I just assumed you would want to certify the percentage freshness.
That's an insane thing. It's an insane thing to try and certify right. the freshness of something. That's like Heisenberg's uncertainty principle. It's less fresh by the time it receives the certification that it applied for. Are you kidding me? What are you talking about?
I'm sorry. My mistake.
But my point is that I think
we've hit upon the real issue that you care about on today's show.
My point is that I think with Atomic Cafe, while maybe we chalk it up as a failure in 2017, its effectiveness in 1982 may be informed by how ineffective it is now.
Yeah.
Or maybe it failed forever, always. But, you know, on Double Feature, Benefit of the Doubt kind of rolls around now and again. And I think that a film that speaks to its audience needs to vanish as the audience ages. I think that that's just something that happens. So I also think it's strange to watch Atomic Cafe in 2018 when, you know, the news narrative that we're getting is there are at least two people with their pinky finger an inch from the bomb.
Yeah.
And see that this is a film in 1982 about the fear of that thing using footage from the 1950s about that thing after a guy in the 1940s, the only person ever actually used it.
Well, if you want to look at it as a person using it and not in the sort of death sentence way of we're all responsible for this terrible thing that happened long before our birth even. Oh, man. A lot to unpack. So let's see if we could go backwards a little bit.
Sure. Yeah, let's see if we can get it smaller and smaller and smaller.
Something about a net. Was there a net involved? One of these songs.
Those things tend to accumulate.
Yeah, okay. I pick things up. I am the accumulator. I mean, Get Out, there's, you know, to that specifically, we talked about it on the show and we both love it. I'm just curious in the way that we look at propaganda, not to say it's going to lose its effect or anything, but if it has as much, I'm there with you. I don't know if it could ever be as effective as it is the day it comes out because of how badly we needed it.
Sure.
But, I mean, also Nazis came back. So what the fuck do I know?
Yeah, I know.
It's going to happen in the future. But these things have to morph over time. They can't be a story that precedes the film that says, okay, what you have to know about this film is it came out in 2017. And
there's actually a really good HBO movie that you should watch before you watch Atomic Cafe.
Right. You don't get to do that. So, you know, it has to work on different levels. And fighting timelessness is obviously a losing battle.
Sure.
So, you know, it's a interesting question, but kind of an arbitrary one to really think about. But you have to when you look at propaganda. And The Atomic Cafe is the first propaganda film that I feel like has really smacked us with that. That wasn't something that I was looking at beforehand. But now the age of the propaganda and the amount of ambiguity, because what we're really saying is missing from The Atomic Cafe in the sense of making it more similar to other documentaries, is also the thing that in the other documentaries, we're going like enough with this mm-hmm. ham-fisted VO telling us.
Totally.
It's actually the very thing we just said. Enough with this whole telling us about the time and place and giving us context.
Right. Totally.
You know, the very fucking thing you can't do, you can do a little bit of in a documentary. The Atomic Cafe was the only one that just by total happenstance I knew about, because it also exists for another reason, which is that it pulled together a lot of this stuff. And it's kind of a study of curation in a way that we haven't thought about too much in documentary form. Documentaries have very different rules than narrative films, but ultimately one thing they can do, don't always have to do, especially with propaganda, but they can create a satisfying story arc. And I think that's a good way to study that form in the documentaries that don't do it particularly subtly, because you can really see how they try to change a person's life into a film. They try to make it about this kind of three-act structured thing. But then you take away the sort of obvious tools of the trade, and all you're left with is the other part that can make documentaries very different, which is just sifting through, I mean, unlimited choices in your footage. In a narrative film, you go and acquire that footage, and then you kind of assemble it as if you stole it. You still assemble it like it's a documentary when you edit a film. Mm-hmm. You still just look at it and go like, I don't know who fucking shot this stuff, but let's just see if there's anything good in here and try and make a movie out of it. But with a documentary, you really are doing that. You're going through, I don't know, tens, hundreds of thousands of hours of footage sometimes. I think that would be about the maximum extent of, fuck, you could just be going through all footage possible to use in human history and then going, we have to find the story in there, or we have to create the story we're looking to tell out of that. And when that story is reaction to the bomb, what you also end up doing is a little bit of reporting. You do a little bit of, I did a music video where I had to get atom bomb footage, and so I had to go find all these sources. So what I found is that the Atomic Cafe had done a lot of this work where it had went and found the actual sources of our test footage and all of these different sites. And so that was a little bit of a shortcut for me to not have to look through hundreds of thousands of hours to find like actual atomic bomb footage. But for a lot of people, the Atomic Cafe is the first time they're seeing an actual atom bomb go off. Mm-hmm. And there are things that, despite what changes over time or whose narrative is trying to manipulate you, some things do cut straight through in a way that is just so immediately dumbfoundingly apparent, like seeing an actual atomic blast, which is to say it's fucking horrifying. Mm-hmm. And no amount of VO or HBO wraparound or any of that changes that when you see the bomb and it's the bomb. You know, context can try and change it a lot, but it's still the atom fucking bomb. Mm-hmm. And it still carries a lot of the weight with it when you look at it, no matter what kind of joke it's being used for.
Sure.
Or,
well, and that's kind of an interesting aspect to the propaganda side of the conversation for this journey, which is how much can you spin something up to and including the point when you show it? You know, like how can you to take to take the original footage, not even Atomic Cafe, but to take the original footage where it's kind of like a PSA, the soldier going, yeah, we're going to watch this bomb.
Uh-huh.
And it's baffling to me that you could watch that and see the explosion and ever not just be afraid. You know, yeah. No matter how yeah. much framing, no matter how much, but don't worry, there's an iron umbrella over all of the United States. It's amazing to watch the propaganda of don't worry, America's got the bomb melt away
yeah.
for me when I see the mushroom cloud and go, it doesn't, it just doesn't matter. Nothing. There is no opinion on this that matters.
Well, this is also a different take to, if you want to see the other end of the spectrum, I think, looking at the same type of reaction, but a different way to do it was Dr. Strangelove.
Well, yeah, it's hard not to think about the title of Dr. Strangelove through this entire conversation.
I know. Well, but that was a movie that, I mean, is... This has been a complicated enough show, so let's invoke a fucking Kubrick film, a notorious Kubrick film. Just why not have a little stinger on the end about that? But it's a movie that in part tries to go, well, there's atomic weapons and I don't know how to live my life anymore. And what the fuck do I do, you guys? And so it tries to actually take atomic imagery and make it funny in a way that the Atomic Cafe didn't. The Atomic Cafe tried to take our reaction, I think, to the bomb and make it funny. The kind of, you know, I mean, Duck and Cover is the easy one to go to, but it's just like the idea of this 1950s cute commercial for fallout shelters and don't worry, you'll just get a little radiation in it, but this little right. Black flag pin on your chest
will let you know if you're dying.
Yeah, tell you how many flags full of radiation you got, and if it's just two, you're totally fine. You can just sneeze it out, everything will be, and then over time to really learn about the effects of radiation and what it can do. And, you know, and even today not being the best argument. I mean, if I were to look at this today and go, what is the scariest thing about atomic bombs? It's that they're tiny. It's that they're so fucking small compared to what we have now. Back when we did then, we go, oh, level a city. Oh, that's cute. What, like a 1 mile radius? Oh, adorable. And you look at today's hydrogen weapons or the one that's been tested, the Russian weapon. I don't remember the name of it. But to do any amount of, you shouldn't do this. People who listen to the show should. You shouldn't because you're terrified of this and it'll just give you nightmares forever. But if you spend any time looking into the weapons that continue to not be used but tested, there have been, God, I should go into this better prepared, but something like 20 atomic weapons that have been set off in the Earth's history. It's just they're not used, you know, in war. There's only two that have ever been used on live targets with the intent to kill.
Say USA, that sentence. Two for two. Booyah.
Say that fucking sentence and then try and make that argument again about how maybe we needed to use it. It's kind of feels kind of like no, at all costs. These are the very, at some point, somebody's going to be sitting on a fucking moon rock floating through orbit with the other four people who are alive and going, but we needed to blow up the Earth because, I mean, somebody was going to do it eventually and it's good that we did it. Fuck those guys. So I'll close with the one thing we didn't get to that you kind of invoked that I wanted to return to a little bit. And that is your question of, you know, if there's a kind of a question about science, if we can do something, does that necessarily mean we should do it as applied to science to say, if science can forward this knowledge, should it? And for the longest amount of time, I thought absolutely. That's the, you know, that's mm-hmm. just the simple answer to if we can learn it, we must learn it. And I don't know, this is the first time I really took a second look at that. I don't know, you know, humans do not have infinite time. We have finite time and resources. And so if science can know the atomic bomb, there's a good argument that says science on a long enough timeline will know it. And maybe it is better to control the time and the place. But also, maybe it's better to take those resources and try and learn other things. and just let us invent the atomic bomb by fucking mistake 100 years later and, you know, pour our resources into something else. Because the fact of the matter is, you know, if there's an answer for the cure to cancer, it's not that Earth just hasn't progressed far enough to know about it. It's just that we have not chosen to dedicate all our resources to it in the ways that we have right. other things. It's not that a species can't cure its own cancer until it's been around for 4,000 years. It's just a matter of finite resources. Even if there were billions of scientists on Earth with unlimited resources, you still have all these people focusing in different areas and to try and choose where are we going to focus. You can look at this with so many advancements of science. When there is inertia behind getting into space culturally, when it's in the zeitgeist, you know, we seem to push forward space technology faster. When we say, God damn it, we're going to the moon, we find a way to go to the moon.
Sure. Just when we say, pour an ice bucket on yourself, ALS gets a ton of money.
See, you see what's up. So, you know, I wanted to open that can of worms so we can think about that. The thing that's been most challenging about the Presidents and Propaganda series to me is that unlike almost anything else on the show where we start with all these questions and slowly start filling things in, every time we see a new piece of propaganda, I go, oh man, we were just looking at the surface of this thing.
Mm-hmm.
And now there's like 10 other unanswered questions. Can't wait till the next time we do one of these fucking episodes. And it's just like, if we can even, we're like people, you know, can't focus. It's just mm-hmm. a lot of questions. Mm-hmm. my delivery yeah. of the very phrase is evidence of that. It's so fucking hard to watch a movie like this, like either one of these, and not just be filled with a brief overview of 50 minutes worth of, okay, I got to go investigate this now. I got to look into this, got to answer right. this. This opens this yeah. whole thing about science I thought I had figured out.
Mm-hmm.
We had a whole area to figure out what the Atomic Cafe thought about atomic weapons and what that means about the documentary form. And also Gary Sinise was in one of these movies. So, you know, do some homework, report in on Twitter. That's at Pling Michael. And what are we doing next time on the show?
Next time we're going to all hail the Shutter Overlords. We're going to do a film called Kuso, which is actually a film, Flying Lotus, I think you call it hip hop. It's very interesting stuff. If you're familiar with yeah. the musician yeah. Flying Lotus, he did a very bizarre movie called Kuso, available on Shudder. We'll tell you a little bit about Shudder in a second. But first, I'm going to tell you the other movie, which is a Quentin Depew movie called Realité.
Oh, that's good. Do you know where your cone accentos are?
On the E.
That's with accent.
Yeah.
It's good.
It's the 2014 film Realité about the perfect scream and
I think it's
waves.
The perfect groan, really.
Waves.
I want to thank Dashiell Shapiro, Camille Dumont, Billy Wilson, John Patrick Kline, Tony Glee, Donald Muzzy, and Mark Abbott, Ross Mueller, Jordan Sells, David Anderson, Charles Crawford, Ben Acker, Aaron Shore, and Abbott. Of Unreason.
Cool. And special thanks to Donald Muzzy. If you want to watch Kuso for $0 and you haven't already done this, you can go to shudder.com/double-feature, which will take you to a magic world where Shudder will cost you $0 for a full fucking month. How about that? How about not having to pay for Shudder for a month?
shudder.com/double-feature.
Do that.
It's right on there.
It's free as fuck, dude. Are you kidding?
Free as fuck. Can we leave this show? The show needs to take its Ritalin. We got to get out of here.
Watch my fucking film.
Bye.
This program is a proud member of the Battleship Pretension Fleet.